On Friday, March 13th, Commander of the United States Forces Korea, General Robert Abrams, noted that North Korea's armed forces have been in lockdown for about 30 days and only recently have started routine training again. Citing one example, General Abrams highlighted that the North Korean Air Force did not fly an airplane for 24 days. He believes this is a sign that the country is trying to deal with the coronavirus outbreak. Meanwhile, Kim Jong-un was featured in North Korea state media supervising live fire artillery exercises. The country has also launched short-range projectiles into the sea. What is going on? Why would North Korea choose to look more aggressive at a time when it could most benefit from international cooperation? Our guest today looks to answer this question. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yong Kwon, and you're listening to Korean Context. We have with us today Senior Director and Fellow at Korea Economic Institute, Troy Stangarone. He's been monitoring economic developments in North Korea for years and recently has been tracking developments in the wake of the coronavirus outbreak in the region. Troy, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So North Korea has yet to report a confirmed case of coronavirus 2019 or COVID-19 to the World Health Organization. But state media noted that nearly 7,000 people are being held for quote-unquote, medical monitoring. In addition, a quarantine was imposed at the westernmost edge of the Sino-Korean border. Are these in a way admissions by the Pyongyang government that there are cases in North Korea?
I think North Korea has been trying to dance around this issue for a while. Officially, they have told the World Health Organization that they have no cases of COVID-19. That being said, we keep seeing indications that this might be the case, be it either the process of people who have been quarantined, which they publicly acknowledged, be it through informal sourcing of things, such as suggestions that bodies are being burned to prevent the spread of disease. So all of these things seem to suggest either on a formal level or an informal level that there is some degree of outbreak in North Korea. What we don't know, as with anything with North Korea, is how extensive that outbreak really is.
And most recently, there was a dramatic reporting that around 200 North Korean soldiers have died due to the coronavirus. But how credible are these reports in your mind?
This is, I think, the challenge. There are certain things that we can roughly verify, things such as with satellite imagery that, for example, we know a ship has coal in it and it's left in North Korean ports, but it's hard to debate that, you know, they're actually shipping coal out. Things of this nature, it's harder to document. There is a fairly robust defector network of people who have contacts still within North Korea. But even if their contact is giving them information that they believe to be true, it may not be the most up to date. It could be that some of those 200 people died of something else. It could also be that North Korea is actually unsure of what they died for. And so there were 200 soldiers who died, but maybe they didn't all die from the coronavirus. So I think there's certain things like this type of information that's anecdotal that we should take as informative of maybe a broader picture, but we maybe shouldn't say it was definitely 200 people. It's more sort of indicative that something is going on perhaps rather than that we know factually that this has happened.
This is a country that in normal circumstances is very opaque about information.
Maybe the most in the world.
Yes, most opaque in the world. And in addition, perhaps it was made more opaque by the very early actions that Pyongyang took as soon as really this coronavirus broke out. In fact, I believe North Korea was one of the first countries to respond to the coronavirus outbreak in China by severing all foreign tourism and closing its borders to Russia and China. What prompted this quick response, do you think? My understanding is that North Korea did not act so forcefully in previous viral outbreaks with SARS or MERS or H1N1. Why would the coronavirus?
In the prior outbreaks, there were a couple of things that I think were different. One, SARS had a high mortality rate but was actually fairly difficult to catch. H1N1, lots of people caught it, but the death rate was fairly low. It was more sort of like a bad version of the flu, even though all of these are types of flu. You also have a factor of that in those cases, what they were largely doing was trying to stem the flow of any infectious disease into the country. And in those cases, what they did is they would take and they would stop foreigners from coming in. That's not necessarily different from this time. They might have slowed trade, but there's contradictory evidence right now about how much they've actually sealed the border. BBC has reported that shipments are still coming in, but they're going through 10-day quarantines. There's defector reporting that foreigners aren't being allowed off ships as they come into port. But that being said, there's also stories that the Chinese have told smugglers, don't try to go into North Korea because the North Koreans will shoot you. So it seems as though they've taken much more extreme steps this time to seal the border, even if maybe there's still some items coming in. I think what's different this time is, one, the scale of the outbreak in China. It's a significant outbreak. The Chinese themselves were taking drastic steps. And two, perhaps most importantly, if this got loose in North Korea, and it seems to be something that is perhaps slightly more contagious than some other diseases, if not as much as H1N1, but also potentially, we've seen very low death rates in South Korea, but in other countries. So take and contrast this with Iran, who also has limited medical infrastructure because of sanctions and other reasons. There you have a fairly high death rate. And so I think the North Koreans perhaps very early on realized that given the limitations of their own healthcare system, that if this were to get out in the countryside, if this were to get out into cities, that there's a good chance that there would be perhaps a significant death rate.
Is it fair to say that North Korea was more attuned to this risk earlier on than other countries in the region? I mean, it seems like the closure of the borders came really soon, to a point where I think there were some jokes being made about how North Korea is overreacting when it happened. What do you think prompted or led to this quick awareness by the North Korean state? Is it, as you say, just higher risk that the North Koreans are feeling?
I think it is a higher risk factor. I also think that at the end of the day, we're also dealing with a relatively new leader. Kim Jong-un, just before he came to power, H1N1 took place. You had a situation to where he saw how MERS perhaps reacted in South Korea, but this is probably really his first major potential pandemic-type crisis. And so, one, you have a different leadership in place. Two, they understand the risk factors. So I think there's different factors at play here this time.
And I imagine with the very recent epidemic amongst the swine population of North Korea, with the swine fever that they contracted from China, that the North Korean state also had this very top of mind, given the high dependence and high vulnerability of North Korea's food stock. So I wonder if that risk might have also been put in the forefront by this other recent event that North Korea was struck by. Of course, you mentioned just briefly earlier that some of the economic activities between China and North Korea might be slowing down. And of course, not unlike other parts of the world, North Korea is heavily dependent upon trade with China, perhaps more so than any other country in the world. What are some of the conditions that might contribute to the economic consequences of the slowdown in trade between North Korea and China?
So I think we can look at this in a few different ways. One, let's look at this in terms of the formal level and things that have not been sanctioned by the United Nations. So right now, if the borders are largely sealed, that means that the roughly 15 to slightly $20 million of exports a month that North Korea has been sending to China is largely probably cut off. So the limited legal earnings that North Korea is making from China have been cut off. Perhaps more detrimental to North Korea is what it was importing from China. It was still importing roughly around, say, about two-thirds of what it was beforehand. That included things like food. So that means that now domestically you're more dependent upon your food stocks and whatever your farmers are able to produce during the winter months. It also means that the industries that you've been trying to build up, like watchmaking, wig making, which have become sort of smaller but new growing export items because they haven't been sanctioned by the UN, now aren't able to gain the inputs that they had from China. So you have these potential export items cut off, not just because of what you're cutting off normally, but you can't even get the parts you need.
Could you actually describe to our audiences like how significant like these smaller items are, like watchmaking and wig making? Like,
so watchmaking is now essentially North Korea's largest export item. I mean, they're still relatively small because, as I was saying, you know, even in the best of months, you're talking about $20-something million in exports. But these are ways for North Korea to try and develop new industries that haven't been sanctioned to try and replace the things that have been taken away, like seafood, like wood exports, coal, and other things. Coal is, because it's a high value, high volume export for North Korea, is going to be hard to replace. But they're trying to take and sort of fill in some of the gaps with these other industries.
Now, of course, with the borders being closed and with traffic of people coming across, it's not just traders either. It's also Chinese tourists, Russian tourists, international tourists who are not allowed to now enter North Korea. I mean, we've seen very similar situation in South Korea where because of concerns regarding people contracting coronavirus in South Korea, we've seen tourism revenues being hit very hard. Is there something similar going on in North Korea?
In the case of North Korea, Chinese tourism was a fairly large revenue earner for them. There's kind of a wide range of estimates, but the low point is North Korea earns about $105 million a year, at least from tourism. Clearly, during winter, we would expect probably fewer tourists in North Korea than in the spring and summer months. So there might not be the losses right now. But one thing to keep in mind is that exports like watches, production can be ramped up and you can make up over time some of the losses from shutdowns or the supply chain shock that North Korea would be going through right now with China. Tourism is not likely to be made up for a couple of reasons. One, people often during any calendar year are reluctant to go somewhere where they think has been unsafe. So you have that issue. Two, a lot of the firms that bring people to North Korea are small firms. And there's a chance that some of these firms might actually go under depending how long this lasts. So you could have a disruption in the ability to bring people in. And three, North Korea itself tends to not want too many people traveling in the country at one time. So to make up the revenues, even if people were willing and the tour companies could bring them, would require North Korea to have larger influxes of tourists than they might want at any given time. So these are likely going to be revenues that simply North Korea has lost, to where maybe some of the exporting things, maybe some of the smuggled items like coal that are going to be slowed down or stopped now, perhaps there's a chance that they could make those revenues up over time. But on the tourism and services areas type side, those are likely permanent losses.
And could you give us a very quick overview of what the breakdown is between legal and illegal exports of North Korea? Like, both of them are being slowed down, but you wrote very recently about how maybe the illicit side of North Korea's exports are playing a bigger role in maintaining North Korea's balance of payments with its external market partners. And perhaps in addition, if you could explain to us what the disruption of that smuggling activity might have on North Korea's economy.
Yeah, so the UN has reported that North Korean coal exports through the first 8 months were worth $370 million. They had an earlier four-month estimate, which suggests that actually over the second 4 months last year, the value and volume was increasing. It appears as though North Korea is still taking and earning close to market value for coal, which suggests that sanctions have largely dissipated in terms of its coal exports, if the UN's data is correct. But at $370 million, that comes out on an annualized basis, if you just do basic monthly averages, to over $500 million. So that would take and allow them to make up a significant portion of their import needs in terms of having hard currency to purchase those. By being able to export things like coal, sand, other items that have been banned illicitly, it starts to explain how North Korea has been able to take and maintain what, at least from the outside, seems to be domestic stability in terms of the economy. While there's reason to maybe wonder if the informal statistics we get from places like Daily NK in terms of the price of rice, the price of petrol, the won-dollar exchange rate are accurate, the one thing that we have seen outside of one or two brief exceptions has largely been price stability, which is surprising because you would expect that if there had been full sanctions enforcement, that as goods became more scarce, you would start to see inflation set in. These kinds of things haven't happened. And while there's reasons why you can discuss that Iran and North Korea are different, if you contrast North Korea with Iran, Iran saw its currency spike by about 60% when the U.S. reimposed sanctions. You've seen significant price inflation of goods in Iran, and you haven't seen these things in North Korea. And what this seems to suggest is that, and this isn't to say that Iran isn't trying to smuggle oil and other things, but is that North Korea potentially has been more successful than Iran at doing it. And also, I think we should acknowledge that North Korea's needs are probably much smaller than Iran's, which has allowed it to largely maintain domestic economic stability.
Right. And so given the importance, the rather hypothetical importance of these smuggling activities, if North Korea's smuggling activities have either slowed or stopped in its entirety because of the coronavirus, what kind of shocks do you anticipate seeing?
Let's move this to the domestic side of the economy now. You have a series of people who work in the markets. We can debate how large the economy is market-based now as opposed to on the state side. But these individuals now have dwindling supplies of goods to sell. So, you know, Chinese rice isn't either coming in formally or being smuggled across the border anymore. The question becomes, has SMEs run out of inputs or goods to sell? What types of struggles do they come under? Now, if we use, say, China as a proxy where, you know, they're going through a similar crisis, SMEs there are facing increasing costs to inputs. They are facing increasing challenges in terms of having revenue. They're facing increasing challenges to having their employees come to work. If some fashion of all of these and other shocks are going through the North Korean system, that would suggest that you have SMEs in North Korea that are struggling right now, more so than they may normally be. And the challenge for North Korea becomes the Chinese state can provide loans. It can provide direct aid to companies. It can work to try and find ways to, in the case of some industries at least, get workers to work and everything. In North Korea, most of the state-run banks don't focus on the domestic economy. So even if they wanted to try and input funds into the economy to support businesses, it's unclear they could. Much of the private sector is funded through the informal Dongju networks. What else is unclear is how much capital do they have available and would they be willing to put into what could be loss-making operations? So will they be willing to come in and support these firms that now might be struggling? And so all of this starts rippling through the economy. But these are also the things that are hardest for us to see because we can look at the formal trade numbers when they come out from China and see, well, okay, how in February did the trade levels adjust? We can look at satellite imagery and see, okay, are more ships leaving or entering port, you know, in North Korea? What's very difficult for us to see is how is the random SME in Pyongyang or somewhere else doing as this goes on? And so I think those might be the most difficult long-term shocks as people get pushed out of business and you see fewer enterprises in place to where some of the external connections might be able, after a few months, to be sort of put back into place.
And of course, North Korea is not alone in facing a lot of these domestic financial challenges, albeit I'm sure it's more dysfunctional than other countries, given, as you mentioned, the lack of formal banking networks, lack of legal market channels that other countries have. But nonetheless, these domestic fluctuations and challenges are not unique to North Korea. The United States is also engaged in interest rate cuts and also potentially more fiscal stimulus to support businesses that might suffer in the case that the outbreak of the coronavirus becomes worse in the United States. But one of the vulnerabilities that you highlight in many of your writings about North Korea is its inability to receive guidance and assistance from international organizations like the International Monetary Fund or the Asian Development Bank, who might be able to help them mitigate some of these consequences of the crisis. Let's just say in an ideal world, Pyongyang opens its doors to these advisors and there are no political barriers to these advisors operating in North Korea, which, you know, these are a lot of hypotheticals. But what kind of policy advice do you think would be most vital at this time for North Korea?
I think right now what you would really want is sort of on the regulatory front, what areas does North Korea potentially have barriers that are making it difficult for these firms to either gain access to cash, to gain access to resources, these types of things. So are there regulatory structures in place in North Korea that are making life additionally difficult for businesses that could be relieved? So one is regulatory reform. And I mean, on a practical level, we can say yes, because all of these businesses work in sort of a legal limbo to where some of their activities are legalized, some of them are not. So fixing some of these, creating more certainty would be one area where they might provide advice. I think you would also likely see advice on the monetary side. North Korea has done a commendable job in taking and maintaining the exchange rate. But the question becomes, what role could the banking system in North Korea play? And I think this is where outside advice in terms of what types of changes on collateral to loans could you make? What types of credit should the banks be extending? Should you adjust the amount of cushion that the banks should have? So, you know, do you draw it down to a lower level to try and encourage more loans? And what are the risks of these moves that the state would need to be looking for to know, like, if it needed to step in and make additional policy changes if things weren't going well? These are the kinds of areas where the international community could step in, help provide guidance on how the state could inject more capital into the markets and also take and loosen regulations to allow the markets to try and adjust better.
These are highly complicated efforts that will probably take very prolonged engagement and very close cooperation between these institutions and the central bank.
And the deepest challenge I think you would have if tomorrow the North Koreans called up the IMF and said, we need help, come help us, is that their system doesn't look much like anyone else's, and it's unclear if they know where the bottlenecks in their system are. And so there would be a lag in terms of the North Koreans kind of explaining through the uniqueness of their system. So that way the IMF could then say, here are the types of reforms we think you need to put in place.
Switching back slightly to public health, we spoke with Dr. John Grundy a few weeks ago, and he highlighted how North Korea's public health relies heavily on human capital in the system in the form of doctors and medical establishments, but that these systems lack medical supplies to actually treat patients. At this point, of course, the United States has reached out and offered assistance, but there doesn't seem to have been much further engagement on this front. Are there any strategic benefits that might compel the United States to be more assertive about providing assistance, either in materiel or technical advice at this time?
I think when we look at this situation, while it's commendable that the United States has offered to provide assistance, I think it was going to always be unlikely the North Koreans would publicly accept U.S. public assistance. A private course might have been something that would have been more viable. Setting aside the actual operational procedures of providing assistance, when we started going down the road of sanctions on North Korea's nuclear program, the intent was never to take and cause humanitarian disaster. Now, we shouldn't be naive and say that there weren't going to be economic costs to the average North Korean, because clearly as you start cutting off trade, that's going to happen. But it was never designed or intended to take and limit North Korea's ability to get medical supplies, food that they might need if there was a drought or something of that nature. So on the one hand, there's a very straightforward, simple moral argument to be made that this is a crisis of health. It's something that China struggled with. Italy has now quarantined its entire country. So while we can talk about the lack of North Korea's investment in its own health infrastructure, even countries with modern developed infrastructures in the healthcare sector are struggling to deal with this outbreak. So there's a moral case to be made. But I also think there's a practical case to be made for the United States. Providing medical assistance to North Korea isn't going to convince North Korea to give up one nuclear weapon or close one factory or anything of that nature. That being said, neither the United States or North Korea trusts each other. And at some point, you have to find ways to start building not even trust, but confidence that one side doesn't wish you harm no matter what, and two, that they might actually be willing to take and keep their obligations if you reach an agreement. And so there was an opportunity here, and perhaps there's still an opportunity here, to try and start building some of that confidence on the North Korean side that, you know what, maybe we can do something with the Americans. It doesn't mean, like I said, that this will lead the North Koreans to come back to talks, but it's these types of things that if you do enough over time, and I think it's important to clarify that it needs to be something like this that actually matters to people, because we do a lot of symbolic gestures, like exchanging of symphonies and things, and those are maybe important first steps. But you need these types of deeper interactions to start building a deeper sense of commitment between the two sides. And I think that's where this health tragedy that we're all facing could be something more.
Now, one big question mark hanging over the international community, especially in the last few weeks, is the fact that, you know, as you mentioned, North Korea could benefit from these trust-building exercises. It could receive international assistance privately or publicly. It could receive guidance and assistance in terms of dealing with some of the economic turmoil that it might be facing. And, you know, this is the perfect setting for it because international community has the cover of saying this is for humanitarian purposes. But we have also seen North Korea fire short-range missiles in the last few days. What is the purpose of Pyongyang's actions to the best of abilities that you can read it? And is this at all related to some of the challenges that the North Korean state is facing with the coronavirus?
I think this is one of those areas that it's very difficult to understand intent. When we see missile tests, we often view them in the context of our own perceptions. There are certain things that we don't know in North Korea. One, these tests could be designed to demonstrate domestically that everything is okay. Nothing has changed. Kim Jong-un is there. He's undertaking these tests. In other words, this could be the equivalent of domestic confidence building by the leadership in North Korea. It's not the way any of us would go about doing it in even countries like China, but perhaps in the North Korean context, there's an aspect of that. Two, this could simply be the North Koreans saying, we have certain innovations that we think we've mastered. We want to test them. We're not going to allow this health crisis, especially because we're not going to seek out international aid to help us with this, or at least not on a government level. We might take private individual level aid, which the UN has been approving, but we're not going to ask the Chinese government, the US government, the South Korean government to provide aid. So there is no disincentive to us to stop testing. So this could just simply be pure calculus in that we have tests, we're going to continue testing, and there's no downside for us doing testing. I think it's unlikely that they're trying to signal something to the international community because, one, if you're sitting in Beijing, I have to imagine that this is not seen as very useful from your perspective right now, given the crisis you're going through and the North Koreans doing this. If you're the U.S., this probably doesn't really incentivize you to come to the table either. And I'd like to think that the North Koreans probably understand that as well, that none of the players would find this as something that's going to make them want to come to the talks quicker, especially because they all have more important things to deal with right now. China has largely, to an extent, been shut down for the last couple months. Like I said, you know, Italy is shut down. South Korea, the air traffic in and out is basically dropped to a very nominal amount, and airlines are running the risk of going out of business. The United States is just starting here, but we've seen a significant decline in the stock market over concerns of this. North Korea is not going to be on the top of anyone's agenda. And if the North Koreans think they can push it to the top of anyone's agenda, I feel as though they're very much misreading the circumstances. So I don't think it's likely that they're trying to signal anything to us. I think it's most likely either for domestic purposes or, as I said, they have tests they need to do and there is no downside from their perspective.
Now, Troy, to close, are there anything about North Korea's response to the coronavirus or North Korea's just handling of just these external pressures that you feel as though are important for American audiences to remember or take away?
I think the key thing to remember is that despite whatever North Korea tries to present as its image externally, there is fragility in this state. There is a lack of an ability to deal with real crises, not necessarily crises of political nature, but crises of either food, crises of health, these types of human crises that states can face sometimes not even through their own inactions, even if in North Korea's case they often don't do the types of things that put them in a position to handle them. And when we think about North Korea, we need to realize that, like with any state, it's not monolithic. It's not of one type of form. And so looking forward, we need to try and think about North Korea and all of our interactions of how do we deal with it as a multifaceted state, one that struggles with a lot of things, one that presents a great threat to the United States and its allies, and to even countries in the region like China. But this crisis, I think, sort of exposes some of the limitations that North Korea has, and I think that that's what I would say going forward.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to Troy Stangarone and to you, listeners, for tuning in. You can find the link to Troy's article for The Diplomat magazine on this issue in the description of this episode. We also recommend you go back and listen to our episodes with KEI fellow Kyle Ferrier on how South Korea is addressing the outbreak, and with Dr. John Grundy on the preparedness of the North Korean healthcare system. We'll have more in the coming weeks. See you then.